All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center, broadcasting live from Silicon Beach here in our office in Santa Monica, California. It's a beautiful day here, and I hope it is wherever you're listening. We have a great show for you today. We're going to cover two very interesting topics on Internet. And the first is the revival of online gambling. They looked at one point with the passage of the Yu-Gi-Oh, the anti-online gambling law that passed in 2003, that online gambling was dead. But we have a special guest to tell us about its revival, none other than Frank Fahrenkopf, who is the head of the American Gaming Association. We'll give you a little more information about him in a second. In the second half hour, we have a return guest and a good friend of the show. Her name is Delphine Haglin, and she is the Washington Director of Reporters Without Borders, and they've just released their annual Enemies of the Internet report, and she's going to tell us about that, as well as we'll talk maybe about some promising signs, possibly of a Burmese spring, maybe. But before that, we have Frank Fahrenkopf on the line, and Frank is a Washington, I guess, American legend. He was the chairman of the Republican National Committee for Ronald Reagan's 8 years in the White House, and six of Reagan's 8 years in the White House, and led the party through successful presidential elections in 84 and 88. And he's the co-chairman of the Commission on Presidential Debates, which he's done a remarkable job in making that an institution when it wasn't, when he first started. He's served in his current role as president of the American Gaming Association for 17 and a half years, and that will be coming to an end in June. So he's definitely been part of a lot of things that have done very well while he's been part of them. Frank, are you with us?
Yes, thanks, Ben. A pleasure being with you.
We were talking earlier and about the revival of online gambling, and a lot of that stems from a Justice Department opinion that the federal laws on gambling do not restrict intrastate online gambling. And so since that ruling, we've seen a couple of states move forward with online gambling. We've had Delaware was the second, Iowa was the first, and now New Jersey just recently stepped in. And so do you see this as signs of a revival of online gambling?
Well, I don't think it's so much a question of revival, because remember, even before the Justice Department opinion, and for at least the last 10 or 15 years, 10 million or so Americans have been going online and wagering on offshore websites.
True.
And this is not something that's really new. What is new here is, as you said, the Justice Department reversed a decades-long position that the 1961 Wire Act prohibits all forms of internet gambling. And what they did on the December 23rd of 2011 was to say, now it only prohibits sports wagering, and all other types of wagering are not covered by the Wire Act. So that has done a couple of things. A number of states have looked at it, particularly their state lotteries, and the state lotteries are under, and their lottery directors are under, a lot of pressure to develop more revenue sources when we're still in a situation where realistically the unemployment rate in this country is probably 15%. And so they took it as an opportunity to what I call perhaps the largest increase in legal gambling in this country's history, either by way of the lotteries themselves or private licensing in state after state.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about online, it's illegal only as to online sports gambling. And but this, this time of year, there's hardly any gambling on sports at all.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There was a federal commission created in the late 90s to study gambling in America. And the testimony that's put forth in that final report that came out in, the middle of 1999, say, when, quoting testimony from FBI and other law enforcement sources, that back then it said that there was bet every year on sports in the United States up to $360 billion, that's with a B, dollars, and less than 1% of that was legally bet either in Nevada sports books or in the parimutuel industry. So I hate to think what the number might be now as we head into March Madness.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Google as now. It's interesting because, you know, there's the millions that are spent. And, you know, I mentioned earlier last week on the show that it just struck me that I was at a Washington law firm and our managing partner faxed in his entry, which I as a young lawyer, I realized that that's like that's triggering like four different federal statutes. But
that's right.
There's something here that they estimate that it cost businesses millions in productivity, $134 million in lost productivity from workers glued to TV during March Madness.
and taking time to fill out their brackets.
Exactly. Yeah, as the NCAA gets bigger, it's harder. Now, in your organization, you know, the American Gaming Association,
yes.
Do you have a difficulty or a challenge in getting your members to agree on online gambling? Because is there a view, or was there a view at one point that online gambling, in essence, competes with, you know, offline gambling?
No, there was never that view. But up until about 3 or 4 years ago, for years, our position was, and I've said it 1,000 times, I know it by heart. I said for years, the American Gaming Association is opposed to all forms of online gaming because we do not believe the technology exists to properly regulate it with appropriate law enforcement oversight. I can't tell you how many times I said that. And the reason that we said that was also because our regulators, you know, were regulated by the states, whether you're talking about Nevada, New Jersey,
right,
Mississippi, Illinois. And the regulators back in the early days of this century, 2000, were very, very skeptical as to whether or not they could properly regulate it. Our view changed dramatically when we saw that more and more countries abroad and first world nations, as opposed to, you know, the Isle of Man or Gibraltar or some of those places, when we had places like Great Britain and France, Italy and other first world nations, showed that with geolocation, with biometrics and so forth, you can ascertain and provide control, that we changed our position. Now, we changed our position, however, only to support federal legislation that would allow online poker and online poker only. And that has still been the position of the, and is the position of the AGA today. Now, there, other than Sheldon Adelson, who has been consistently opposed to all forms of online gaming, although that's his personal view and not the position of Las Vegas Sands, because they are members of our association. Everyone else is very strongly in favor of that legislation, which we were very hopeful was going to be introduced by a very conservative Republican named John Kyle, from a senator from Arizona who has now left the Senate, and Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, but they never actually introduced that legislation.
Right. There was a lot of talk about that last fall, and it just didn't happen. Now, in terms of getting online gambling and moving forward with it,
mm-hmm,
at the state level, do you think that now the state regulators have the adequate tools? And also, why the distinction between poker and other forms?
Well, first of all, with regard to the exception for poker, when we were putting forth our arguments on the Hill for legislation to authorize it, I can be very candid with you that we felt that the only appetite that there might be in any chance of passing any legislation was for poker only, in that poker is conceptually different in that it's a game that has a long history in the United States, in the history of this country. It's acceptable socially. It's great. Families have poker parties. There's poker games every night here in Washington with members of the Senate and the House and some former Supreme Court justices. We're fully supportive. Plus, it's not a house-banked game. In other words, you know, you're not playing against Caesars. You're not playing against AGM. You know, they're taking their drag on the pot before it goes in. And if we're playing, I'm playing against you, Bennett, and you're playing against me. We're not playing against the House. So that's how the bill was crafted. And we were able to gain support of people like Senator Kyle, who fundamentally is anti-gaming, on the basis that it's the lesser of two evils. Getting a bill through that just allows poker is better than just letting anybody go forward with online gaming with any type of gain, as we're seeing with the legislation that passed in Delaware, that we're not only talking about poker, we're talking about games that look like slot machines, any casino-type games, whether you're talking roulette, blackjack, etc., which, as I said, would be the largest expansion of legal gaming in this country's history. So that's why we were able to gather support of people like Senator Kyle and others. And Joe Barton, a congressman from Texas, who has introduced poker legislation in the last two sessions of Congress and who's studying doing it again right now. Senator Reid has also said that he's hopeful to introduce something. So we'll just have to wait and see as we go forward. As you know, there are perhaps more important things on the agenda of the United States House and Senate with the economic things we face in this country than poker, but we'll have to see what happens.
Now, in terms of the advancement at the state level, and as you mentioned, Delaware is more than just poker, does that hurt your ability to get federal legislation or make it easier? Because
no, I think it may be easier, Bennett. That's a very good question, because I think historically, when you start talking about gaming, it's not a partisan issue. In the Republican Party, it tends to be those on the farther to the right who, because of moral religious reasons, view gaming as a sin. In the Democratic Party, it tends to be those on the far left who aren't that concerned about sinning, but who don't believe people are smart enough to make their own decisions about how to spend their own money, and that government's got to protect them from themselves. So you have both right and left who are opposed to anything having to do with gaming. Now, a lot of those people who were reluctant to consider a poker bill over the last two sessions are now saying, wait a minute, look what's happening in these states. This is a rapid, open expansion. And I think they're taking a second look now. Now, the danger of this for what's going on in the states also is there is a very, very strong group, particularly in the Republican Party, who would just as soon go back and outlaw all forms of gaming on the Internet. In other words, not even have a poker exception. And I would not be a bit surprised if a poker legislation doesn't get moving, that you would see that sort of legislation that would just totally outlaw all forms of Internet gaming in this country. That could happen.
Now, in terms of right now you have three states, what do you think is a likely point where we'll be, say, at the end of the year or the end of next year in terms of number of states that have it?
Absent federal legislation, I think you're going to see a tremendous rush to look at this. I mean, we already know that New York and Illinois and Louisiana and other states have either legislation that's already been introduced or there's plans to introduce it. California's been kicking this around for 10 years.
Right.
The problems there have had more to do with Native American tribes disagreeing among themselves, along with some of the card rooms and the paramutual folks. Absent federal legislation, I think you'll see more and more states that are going to go forward. And they'll go forward in a couple of different ways. Some may only go poker. If you look at what Nevada did, they only went with poker. New Jersey and as we've discussed, Delaware have gone with other casino-type games. So I think you'll see a diversity across the country. Different states will go different ways. And then you'll also see diversity as to whether or not it's going to be run in that state, those states that enact it, by the state lottery, which means it would shut out any private companies from mm-hmm. coming in and offering their services, or whether or not they will open it up in a particular state and let companies that want to provide Internet services bid against each other for the right. So I think you'll see a tremendous rush. I don't want to say whether it'll be 10 states or 20 states, but I think you'll see a tremendous interest expanding.
Well, your answer raised the interesting thought about states being the laboratories of democracy. and Congress often, you know, allows states to tinker and try different solutions before sometimes a federal solution is devised. Do you think that, you know, Congress might want to take a hands-off approach and see how this develops at the state level, or?
There's no question there probably will, some will take that, but I mean, when you're dealing with the internet, I mean, it is clear that if you start to get into intrastate activity rather than, interstate rather than intrastate. In other words, right now the legislation in the three states we've talked about provides for intrastate. It's within the boundaries of the state.
Right.
Which, as far as I'm concerned, clearly meets the mandate of the 10th Amendment, that, you know, each state has the right to determine whether or not they're going to have gambling, if so, what kind, and how they're going to regulate taxes, etc. But when you start crossing state lines, for lawyers in the audience, I mean, I think you immediately get into Commerce Clause problems.
Right.
And then in many states, particularly those that just go for poker only, as you know, in order to have successful online poker, you need liquidity. You need a lot of players. Nevada, my old home state of Nevada, doesn't have enough people to have that liquidity. So if Nevada then tried to make a deal with California, for example, a state with a tremendous amount of people, so that there would be sufficient liquidity so that there could be generated profit from the online poker, the question is, would Congress have to approve? Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution specifically provides that interstate agreements have to be approved by Congress. Now, what's happened historically for about the past 20 years is Congress has ignored agreements between states. Most of them involved electrical grids or power agreements and so forth, and Congress, rather than acting or by approving or disapproving, has just ignored them. But as I said, with these elements in both political parties, if you had a group of states that were going to do something along this line to gather together for interstate, clearly signals going across state lines, you might very well have a movement in Congress to have hearings and consider whether or not to approve or disapprove that.
Now, in looking at online gambling versus offline gambling, and one thing is, you mentioned poker earlier, and for listeners, poker often comes up as something that should be allowed. Because what makes online gambling or offline gambling illegal is there are three elements usually to the offense of what is having a lottery. You have to have it has to be a game of chance, and then, you know, there has to be money involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the view of poker in some places is that poker isn't a game of chance; it's a game of skill. And so, therefore, it shouldn't be regulated as...
Well, that's an argument that a lot of people have made. It's not only here in this country, but almost every court, and clearly the higher appellate courts who have looked at that, have agreed that it's a game of skill, but they also add it's also a game of chance. And then
it
falls
card.
Within the... Yes, falls within the mandate of the definition of gambling. So, but there's many, many people who hold that view.
Especially if you're good.
Yes, that's right.
I tend to be on the game of chance side, but and looking at it, we've had some experience now of maybe a decade or so of online gambling. And is there any studies or evidence to show that, you know, a lot of people object to gambling because, you know, the problems of addiction and, you know, what the consequences that result from that. Has there been anything to show that, you know, there is any difference between online gambling or offline gambling?
No, most of the studies that have looked at it, there's been nothing as definitive as some of them that, studies that have been done in brick-and-mortar history, both here in the United States and abroad. But one thing is clear, that, and it wasn't clear 17 and a half years ago when I took this job at the president and CEO of the American Gaming Association, was the whole question of how many people meet the diagnosis qualifications of the American Psychiatric Institute for being pathological gamblers. And we now know from studies done here, but primarily work done by Harvard Medical School's Division on Addictions, and studies that have been done worldwide, that we know no matter where you are, it's about 1% of the population that can't gamble responsibly. And these are people who will commit a crime, who will lose all their money, who'll break up marriages, it'll cause bankruptcy. It's a very, very difficult thing. We know that it's 1%. We also know that of that 1%, 60% or so, the experts tell us, suffer from what's called comorbidity, which means the gambling's not their only problem. They have problem with drugs, alcohol, et cetera. They have addictive personalities. So that's why our industry has, for the past 15 years, and we've been commended by Congress and others as the industry that stepped up to the plate, put money where our mouth is to finance and help peer-reviewed research into how we can help people who have that problem. And but, you know, even as gaming has spread across the country, we've seen that more and more, because, you know, you have some form of legal gambling in every state in the United States except two. It's only Hawaii and Utah that have no form of legal gambling. But the studies that have been done by the scientific community indicate that even though it is spread, it's still about 1% wherever we are. So that argument, you know, is important for that 1%. And I think the industry has an obligation to do something concerning it, as we are. But it's a false argument to say that if online gaming is somehow legalized in this country, we're going to have an increase in pathological gambling. I don't think there's any evidence for that.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but I bet that when we come back, we're going to have Frank, and we'll wrap up this segment. And after these messages, you're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Time now for another exciting episode of
Face of Analytics,
brought to you by AnalyticsSEO.com. In our last adventure, our hero was fending off his evil nemesis, Rhino the Algo.
That ruthless rhino has updated the algorithm again, and our website is falling down the rankings fast.
Have no fear. Use our automated SEO tool to stay updated and to monitor your site with detailed reports. Or use our multi-site project management tool to manage all of your sites to stay on top. Take it from our fearless friend and be your own SEO hero with AnalyticsSEO.com.
Aim clear. This is how you sell with social.
Have you tried to do CPA conversions using social PPC and failed? You're not alone. These days, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube require true specialists
to dominate. AimClear, the agency,
brings definitive psychographic targeting,
bleeding-edge creative,
and killer content amplification to the social advertising table.
AimClear. This is how you sell with social. AimClear. This is how you sell with social.
Building better search engine rankings takes the right formula. Tracking those rankings is super simple.
All you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
Authority Labs uses automated daily rank tracking tools to monitor your site's performance or leverage their API to build your own tools. No matter what animal-labeled algorithms affect your ranking,
you should be using Authority Labs.
Unlimited users for no additional cost and white labeling can help keep your clients updated and save countless hours of creating reports. Whether you're running sites with just a few or millions of keywords,
what you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back with Frank Farencourt, the president of the American Gaming Association, and he was just mentioning that he's retiring at the end of 17 and a half years as head of that organization. Frank, tell us a little bit about the AGA.
Well, the AGA was really formed in the mid-90s by the brick-and-mortar industry as a result of a proposal that was floated on Capitol Hill for a 4% gross receipts tax, federal gross receipts tax, on all gaming revenue in the U.S. And it didn't last very long because 30 governors signed a letter to President Clinton saying that, you know, their states depended on the revenues from their lotteries and pari-mutuel industry and casinos, Native American casinos, et cetera. And it was dropped. But it sort of was a clarion call to the industry that they better have representation here in Washington. And the AGA is not just the operators like Caesars and and Las Vegas Sands and MGM, et cetera, but also manufacturers, IGT, International Game Technologies, WMS, Bally's, manufacturers of gaming equipment. And so the association was formed back in 95, and they came to me because I'm originally from Nevada, and I represented a lot of companies before Nevada gaming authorities over the years. I stayed here in Washington after I retired from being chairman of the party after President Reagan left, and to do it and get it started for a year. I agreed to do it for a year, and that was 17 and a half years ago. So I'm going to, it'll be 18 years when I step down on June 30. I'm not retiring. I'm just going to move on to something else. 18 years of doing the same thing, I don't think is healthy for an individual or the company he works for. So it's time for some new blood, new thinking. And so we're looking forward to, I'm looking forward to welcoming somebody else in this job, come July 1.
My father took a 6-month job that lasted 29 years.
Oh, wow.
So I know what you mean. Now in the short time we have left,
yes.
First of all, congratulations. Today is the anniversary of the founding of the Republican Party that you once so capably chaired. And but you now have also played a role as on the debate commission, the Commission on Presidential Debates.
Yes.
And we were talking offline about the debates. And when you came on, when you were, for example, when you were on the Reagan campaign, at that time, there was a gap from the Kennedy Nixon debate in '60 to the Carter Reagan debate in '80, that there hadn't been any debate.
No, actually, it was from 1960. Everyone remembers the modern
television
debates. Yeah, because Ford debated Jimmy Carter in 1976, but we went 16 years without a presidential debate because Richard Nixon. And I had talked to President Nixon about it at length. The 1960 debate was with JFK. Was very traumatic for him, so there was no way he was going to debate when he ran twice for president thereafter. Lyndon Johnson was not going to let Barry Goldwater get up on the stage with him. So Gerry Ford really didn't have much choice in 1976 because he was behind in the polls because, if you remember, he had pardoned Nixon.
Yeah.
And so the debate was took place in 1976. We were not involved then. We didn't start until 1988 that we began. Then President Reagan was always ready to debate. He loved the debate process. And then Bill Clinton was very, very happy to debate, as President Obama was the last two times.
So what I asked you offline was really, at what point did you realize that this was now an institution? And do you think a candidate could win the nomination and say, no, I'm not going to debate?
No, I don't think so anymore. I think the American people have reached a point. We know, in fact, some polling that was done right after the debates this last election in last year, 2012, mirrored what we've seen for about the past 10 years, that about 65% to 70% of the American public say that the presidential general election, now I want to differentiate between the primaries. We have nothing to do with the primary debates. We do the general election debates. That 65% to 70% said that debates are very important, not the only criteria, but very important in who they vote for. So I don't think today that that a candidate could win the election by saying they're not going to debate. Now, President George Herbert Walker Bush did that for a while in 1992. He refused to debate. You remember back then it was not only Bill Clinton, but Ross Perot.
Yes.
And it wasn't until Clinton supporters started showing up at President Bush's rallies dressed in yellow chicken costumes that he was forced at the last minute to agree to debate. But I don't think today that a candidate could get by without without agreeing to debate.
Yeah, I mean, it's that campaign, I was involved with the Clinton campaign, and but people forget that there was a point when Clinton was in third in that race.
No, that's right. That's absolutely right.
And I really want to thank you for coming on board, but I have to ask you one quick question.
Sure.
Since it is pertinent to your role. Have you submitted your bracket, and who is your final four?
I do. I did submit my bracket. Out of the Midwest, I have Duke coming through. It'd be a tough game with Louisville, but I think they can carry that Midwest bracket. I have in the West I have Ohio State beating Gonzaga to get into the Final Four. In the South, I have Kansas beating Georgetown to get in the Final Four. And then I have Indiana defeating Miami in a good game. So the Final Four is Duke playing Ohio State, and I give the nod to Duke. And I have Kansas playing Indiana, and I give the nod to Indiana. And I have Duke beating Indiana for the national championship.
Well, there you have it, everyone. If you haven't submitted yours, that's from the legends. Frank, I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you both online and off. And you definitely have distinguished yourself in both politics and with the AGA. And it's really been an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Anytime, Bennett.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our next guest is Delphine Hagelin, and she has been on the show before. We talked last year about the Reporters Without Borders. They had their annual Enemies of the Internet report, and we outlined that report, and she talked about what Reporters Without Borders is doing. And it's been they're a very active group in promoting a free press, and both in all countries, really. And so, in every year they come out with a report on the enemies of the internet, and that is part of an effort to make people aware of online censorship, and they have actually an International Day Against Online Censorship. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have Delphine Hagelin with Reporters Without Borders. You listen to the Cyber Law and Business Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief S for our sponsors.
If you're like most digital marketers, you've probably got conversion rate optimization at the top of your list of priorities for 2013. Conversion rate optimization is one of the most effective ways to increase revenue and grow profits. You can master your website conversion optimization skills at Conversion Conference San Francisco 2013. Conversion Conference San Francisco 2013 is the only digital marketing conference entirely focused on getting more web visitors through your conversion funnel. Learn how to create persuasive content, design landing pages that trigger your visitors to action, and convert blog readers into customers. Conversion Conference San Francisco 2013, April 15th through the 17th, is quickly selling out. Register with discount code WMFM for $100 off your registration. Sign up today for Conversion Conference San Francisco 2013 at conversionconference.com. That's conversionconference.com.
Oh, yeah. My day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use certifiedknowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
The SES Conference and Expo is making a springtime stop to New York City, March 25th through the 28th. SES New York 2013 is moving to a brand new venue in the heart of Times Square at the New York Marriott Marquis. Register now at sesconference.com. SES New York 2013 features some of the best and brightest minds in search and social marketing with keynote addresses by top-level executives from Google, Twitter, ESPN, and more. SES New York 2013 will also feature a loaded expo hall and Texpo Pavilion, on-site training by the ClickZ Academy, WebmasterRadio.fm's annual search bash, and so much more. SES New York 2013 at the New York Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square, March 25th through the 28th. Register now at sesconference.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here.
This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we have Delphine with us. Delphine, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for coming back to the show. Delphine is the Washington Director for Reporters Without Borders, and it's an international organization. Are you affiliated with Doctors Without Borders?
People ask me the question often. So we are not. We are kind of cousins, I guess, because Doctors Without Borders and Reporters Without Borders are both French organizations, and they were created at the same time. And actually, there's a small story who linked each other. Actually, when Doctors Without Borders was created and when they went to Africa to help different countries to fight against famine, the founder of Doctors Without Borders were actually enraged by that there was no press coverage of what was happening in Africa. And in a sense, we were created to answer that call, because we, and it's not just by sending Western journalists when there is a crisis, but by helping local journalists to do their job every day in a crisis situation and in authoritarian regime. And that's our mission, to help journalists all over the world to do their work.
Now, Doctors Without Borders has won the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So one day we will win it too.
I'm sure that is a possibility, particularly in light of your recent work. And one thing that your organization has done, as we mentioned, is have an annual Enemies of the Internet. And what makes someone an enemy of the Internet?
So what we qualify in our report as an enemy of the Internet was, first of all, the state, which were monitoring online activity, but also filtering internet connection in their own countries. So since many years, we were publishing list of countries which were, as we say, enemies of the internet. But this year, for the first time, we also focus on five states which are conducting systematic online surveillance that results in serious human rights violation, like Syria, China, Iran, Bahrain, and Vietnam. But also, for the first time, as I said, we also focus on five companies that we qualify enemies of the Internet, because we consider that actually the companies who are selling products to authoritarian governments to commit violation of human rights are actually like kind of digital mercenaries. And in this report, we highlight Gamma, Trovicore, Hacking Team, Amesis, and Bluecoat, who are all Western companies, American, French, Italian, British. And we consider that when a company is selling filtering software or monitoring software to Libya, to Syria, or to Iran, they have to be taken responsible, accountable for the tools, the arms they are giving to these governments who are known to violate human rights.
Now, we actually had someone on a couple of weeks ago to talk about Bluecoat. You know, they did some research and kind of documented some of what you were talking about. But just to make clear, technology itself is neutral. Technology
yes.
doesn't do anything bad or good unless, you know, it can have uses that can be bad or good. And mm-hmm. And highlighting, you know, these companies that offer this technology, it's the crime isn't the technology, it's who they're getting in bed with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The technology is neutral, and filtering or monitoring internet can be useful and should be useful in many cases to try to track a pedophile or terrorist. We completely understand that, but we have also to adapt our behavior when we are talking about governments who are known to arrest their dissidents, their opponents, and when a company is giving the tool to a country like Iran or Syria or Libya to monitor the online activities, to monitor the Skype conversation, to monitor the Gmail exchange. The companies have to adapt their behavior to this local situation and to understand that the consequences of selling monitoring software like that will have huge consequences in human rights regard.
Now, of the five companies you named, have any of them responded to their inclusion in the report?
Actually, we are still waiting to hear from the companies, and there's two companies that we cannot have communication with them right now because we filed a complaint against them at the OECD level for the technology they sold to Bahrain.
And the OECD is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It's a kind of a consortium of the leading Western developed nations.
Yes. We hope that first initiative, this legal initiative, could bring attention to this monitoring market, but also could encourage Western governments to adopt legislation to control more the export of digital arms. Actually, the U.S. and the European Union already forbid the export of this software to Iran and to Syria, and we hope that they can extend this export control to other countries. And actually, we advocate for European governments to take an harmonized approach to control the export of surveillance technology. And also, we encourage the Obama administration to adopt legislation like the Global Online Freedom Act, or more the technology sold by American companies.
In the Global Online Freedom Act, that's the act that's been introduced practically every Congress for about 10 years now by Representative Chris Smith from New Jersey. And I don't know if it's been offered yet this year or not. But
it's still a proposition, and as you said, it's hard to be adopted. And even if the hopes are thinner and thinner, I think we have to continue to push for the controls of export of surveillance software.
And is that a matter of not necessarily having the laws in place because they are in place, it's just a matter of enforcing them?
Sorry, could you repeat your question?
Sure. You said your focus now, given that legislation may not be likely, but your focus is now more on getting countries to use export controls to restrict this type of technology from getting in the wrong hands. And so is it your view that the legal framework is just exists, it's just a matter of governments enforcing the law?
I'm sorry, I hear you badly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess the question is you're focusing and you're trying to get governments to enforce their export control laws or to apply export control laws to prevent the technology from getting in countries like Syria or Bahrain, right?
Yes.
And so is it your view that the law is already the law already prohibits this conduct, or do you need more laws to strengthen it?
We need more laws to strengthen that control, and because we want that monitoring software could be considered as real arms, real tools which could hurt people. And so that's why we are pushing, because for the moment there's no control at all on how authoritarian regime or dictatorship can have access to this technology that they use to arrest journalists and citizens. So yes, we are advocating for more legislation to control this export.
It's an amazing, you know, just kind of playing in my head your response. And what's interesting is that if you had said the same thing maybe 15 years ago, that we need to treat software as a weapon. I think people would have been astounded by it. But people are realizing that with cyber war and all these other aspects, that this is definitely can be as much a weapon as anything else.
Yeah. And I think the news are bringing us every day new cases, which makes this cyber war more real. There was the New York Times hacking in the beginning of the year. But I can give you many examples. I can give you the example of a Syrian activist who was arrested end of 2011, Karim Temur. And when he was interrogated, actually he was shown around 1,000 pages of transcripts of all his Skype conversation and exchange of documents with
wow.
all his contacts. That's just an example of what the Syrian government is able to do right now. And actually, it's not an hazard if at the beginning of the uprising in Syria in February 2011, after years of blocking Skype, Facebook, and Twitter, the Syrian government gave access again to the Syrian population to this website because they wanted them to use them because they were able to monitor what was happening on Facebook and Twitter. So for the Syrian government to give access to social networks during the uprising was the best way to know what the young population, what the opposition, what the dissidents were doing.
It's interesting, the whole concept of that there's some book, Hide in Plain Sight, where they want, this is the opposite. They want you to come out so they can watch you.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's I think, really striking. And so when actually you have to be careful if you are in Iran or in Syria or in Bahrain, and for many months a website was blocked, and if suddenly, I can access it, it's not an hazard, or you have to understand what it means.
Right. Be careful what you wish for. You might get it, and then it'll be monitored. Now, this is obviously very important stuff, but I want to talk, there's certain hopeful things that I've seen that you guys have posted. And one is it appears that you guys are somehow hopeful about a Burmese spring, even though Burma is listed as one of the enemies of the internet.
Yeah, actually the improvement of the situation regarding press freedom and online freedom is amazing in Burma. So we can, it's always good to not talk about the really sad and awful situation, but yes, thank you for bringing that. In some countries with no violence, freedom could improve. And when you mentioned the case of Burma, there are no more journalists in jail in Burma. There is no more prior censorship system for the press in Burma. And we hope this Freedom Spring will continue to improve the general situation in Burma. There are still many challenges and many difficulties, but things seem to be going in the good direction.
Now, one other area to keep an upbeat note is you also recently, in conjunction with the Enemies of the Internet report, you named a netizen of the year, a gentleman from Vietnam. Can you tell us about him?
I don't know him personally, but it's important for us to just say that the award was given to him because he was elected by internet users all over the world. More than 70,000 people went to discover the awardees, and he was selected. So actually we were very, in a sense, satisfied to see that the situation in Vietnam brings attention to the internet users all over the world. And he's a free man. He was able to come to Paris to receive his award, and we were very, very proud to make him come to Paris to receive this award because he's a very talented and courageous blogger who is describing the situation in Vietnam with a lot of courage and a lot of rigorousness. And when I'm saying courage, I just want to highlight that right now there are at least two journalists who are jailed in Vietnam, and more than 30 netizens. By netizens, I mean people who are not journalists, but who were expressing themselves online and were jailed for that. There's a real war against bloggers in Vietnam, and the Vietnam government has implemented really precise legal arms, if I can say, to be able to jail the bloggers.
We only have a few minutes left, Delphine. So if by the time we have left, if people want to go download the report or learn more about your organization, where should they go?
Of course, they can go to our website, which is Reporters Without Borders. It's a website in English, French, Spanish, and Russian, so I'm sure everybody could find this information in their own language. So if they're interested in this issue, they can go to read our big report, which was published on March 12th on the enemies of the Internet. But I also invite them to go to another website, which is called WeFightCensorship.org. WeFightCensorship.org, where we publish regularly tips for journalists or citizen journalists to teach them how to protect their communication online, how to protect their data, how to encrypt their data, how to encrypt their communication. And we also publish on this website, WeFightCensorship.org, the censored content of the journalists we are defending. So when we are saying, oh, a Vietnamese blogger was jailed because he wrote something on corruption, you can actually find this article translated in English online. So we are very proud of this project, which can make, which aims to make the censorship inefficient, in a sense.
Well, thank you very much, Delphine. Well, I should say merci beaucoup, and à bientôt. I thank you for coming back. It's been a pleasure. And everyone, this is an important group, and they've done great work in terms of highlighting global attempts at Internet censorship. And so definitely go to their website, check it out. If you're a blogger, particularly if you're a blogger outside the United States, you should take a look, because your life could be on the line. And Delphine, thank you again, as always. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. So we only have a few minutes left. I just want to do a few shout-outs. Today actually was the anniversary of the founding of the Republican Party, so it was perfect that we had Frank on. It's purely coincidental. Today is the day John and Yoko got married in Gibraltar near Spain, as they say in the song. And today is also Anna Doyle's 89th birthday. Unfortunately, she didn't live to this day, but cheers to her, and cheers to Myra Roberts, the internationally renowned hair designer in Silver Lake, California. But that's all we have for today. I want to thank all of my guests again, and I hope if you're listening, you consider getting our mobile app so you can take us with it wherever you go. And please do tell me where you go. Postcards are welcome. But thanks again to everyone, and we'll be back next week with another show. But we're going to be continuing some of these discussions on online gambling. We're going to be talking a little bit later on about the whole international trade dispute between the United States and Antigua, which has really become almost like a TV movie, the way that's twists and turns. But as it stands now, Antigua may be authorized to start becoming an online pirate and selling U.S. Goods without paying license and over royalties. And so that's a very controversial matter. So we'll be back next week. This is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center. I'm here from the heart of Silicon Beach in Santa Monica. Good luck with your brackets. May the best team win. And we'll see you next week right here on Cyber Law and Business Report.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.